Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to another Geek Town Behind the Scenes podcast. I'm your host, Dave Elliott, and we're back this week chatting to one of not only my favourite composers, but one of my favourite people that I love talking to, Mr. Phil Eisler. For those of you that don't know Phil, we've spoken to him five times. This will actually be the sixth time I've interviewed Phil. He is the composer behind shows such as Revenge, Unreal, Dietland. He did the recent Netflix series What If. He also did all the music for Empire as well. He's a film and TV composer. His movies have included things such as the Chips film, working with Dax Shepard, To the Bone, which was the brilliant Marty Noxon's directorial debut. He's worked multiple times with Melissa McCarthy and her husband Ben Falcone on the movie Life of the Party and their upcoming film Superintelligence. They're doing another one as well. He's also quite active with his support against gun violence in the US, particularly the school gun violence. He's done music for a couple of documentaries for that, one of them being Newtown, which is a heartbreaking and brilliant documentary, and more recently one called Us Kids as well, which was to do with the Parkland kids and just the whole issue in general. He started off his career playing guitar for Robbie Williams and has actually written a number of songs for Robbie. One of those is quite recently, so we do discuss a little bit about that. We talk about his new TV and film work, so there's a bunch of new projects he's working on. He is one of the hardest working people in Hollywood right now. He had time to fit in a symphony which he wrote for Sarah Chan, who's an incredible violinist, and we talk a bit about his inspiration behind writing that. We also joke a little bit about his friend and fellow composer Nathan Barr, because him and Nate we've had on the show probably the most amount of times out of any composer. Phil is still ahead right now, but they did work together on a project called Silent Movies Live, which was at Nate's studio. Nate, if you've not heard his interviews, he rescued this big Wurlitzer organ from Fox and he built like an entire studio around it. So we talk a little bit about, we were joking about that. Just a little language warning in this, quite often I will take all the swearing out of these podcasts, but it sort of ruins the flow a bit for this. So there are some F-bombs in here, just so you're aware. If you're listening with young kids and don't want to hear the language, there are a few F-bombs in here, entirely appropriate at the points that he uses it, but just wanted to make you aware of that, just in case you've got small children around you, you don't want to hear the language. As I said, this is the sixth time we'll be speaking to Phil. He's lovely, he's brilliant. I actually did this interview in person. I went to his studio in LA to sit down and chat with him. I should also mention I was in the middle of getting over a cold at the time. I had a very sore throat, so if I sound a bit croaky, that's why. It was a lovely, lovely conversation. Every time we've tried to set this up previously, we've kind of missed each other and I've been there and he hasn't, or he's just been too busy. It's lovely to finally manage to sit down and chat with him. Here is the interview with Phil Eisler.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Well, it's nice to actually be able to sit and talk to you in person.
Right. Yeah, we're usually on the business end of a Skype call somewhere.
Yes, usually. I'm somewhere in the UK. Although, as I walked into the lot, it started raining. I think they knew two English people were meeting. It started raining outside.
Your fault. Your fucking LA weather jokes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So 2017 was the last time we actually spoke. It's been a while.
Was it that long ago?
Yeah.
Blimey. I tell you what, I lose all perspective of time.
I know, yeah. Stuck in your little bunker. That's what it is. I think you just done To the Bone.
Right. Just gone to Sundance, actually, yeah.
Yeah, probably. And
history repeating itself.
You just had your second kid.
My God.
So.
Well, she's.
I can see, yes.
3 and a half.
Yeah, exactly. So.
Yeah, wow.
So, yeah, you just had another kid and you just done Chips. I think most Chips was the thing we mainly talked about. So.
Crazy.
So, yes, how have you been since then?
I've been busy, yeah. Been good, though. Raising the kids.
Mm.
Been super busy. God, I don't know, do you want me to... if I was to take you through all the projects I've done since then, it would take us half a day, but...
some of the big things, I mean, Empire, you...
Sure.
Finally coming to it.
It is, yeah, after over half a decade. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, so it's crazy.
Crazy.
Still be working on that. Super intelligence.
Yeah, that was really fun, actually. And I think what I heard today, as it happens, was that it's whenever this HBO Max... Is it HBO Max now? That they have so many channels. I forget which
HBO
one.
HBO Max.
HBO Max. Whenever that's coming out, whenever that launches, which I thought...
Spring, I think.
In the spring? I thought it had already launched. I was, you know, maybe I missed the whole thing. Anyway, so supposedly that's now going to be one of their lead movies that they're opening up with. And that was, I heard that that was Ben's decision, that he wanted to, you know, he wanted to try this new platform and thought more people might see it and all of that.
Yeah,
I think it's smart, you know, because it all seems to be going that way. That said, you know, it was a movie we definitely made for the big screen and it was a big score. It was a huge orchestra and a choir and all done here in LA and. Yeah, it was fun. Mm. And I'm due to do another one with them, actually.
Oh, cool.
Called Thunder Force, which is a superhero movie.
Oh, wicked.
And it's really good. I don't know how much about it I'm allowed to say. I know there's been stuff in the press about it, but it's Melissa and Octavia Spencer.
Mm.
That's another big undertaking, that one. Because it's a superhero movie, so you know.
Yeah, of course.
So fun. Yeah, so there's been that. And then what else?
That's like that'll be the third thing you've done with Melissa.
Yeah. I just, you know, honestly, Ben and Melissa are some of the loveliest people in the world.
I've been told that.
They are just super cool. Ben's easygoing, but knows what he wants. He's just an absolute joy to work with. They both are. They're great. So I never say no to a gig with them. They're always really fun.
Yeah. I spoke to the production designer on Nobody's, I think it was, which was the show they exec produced. Mm-hmm. And they were like, he was like, this is great because they bought in like their own furniture from the house to use because they thought it was appropriate, you know.
Right. That's hilarious. Yeah. I mean, they're fun. And this is logistically a big film because the whole superhero bit, and we're recording in London, so it's it's a bit of time at Abbey Road or we at, I forget if we're at Abbey Road or Air this time, but you know, it's just fun, man, just loads of fun.
Yeah, so I mean, are you with that being a sort of comedy superhero movie, do you know where you're going with the sound with that yet?
Again, I don't know how much I'm allowed to say, and it's I haven't even seen the film yet, so
right,
you know, and it's a little ways away.
Yeah,
but I have a few ideas from reading the script, but I sort of most of my movies, even if see, because movies these days, very rare that you get a locked movie and you're just on. I haven't done one like that. since I don't know how long ago, and those were indie movies anyway. I don't think I've ever been on a studio movie that's actually been locked until it was in the theater, pretty much.
Right. Yeah.
So you know, my involvement usually starts with either reading a script or having a conversation with the director about what they want their film to be, because that's almost a better. It gives me a better idea than just reading the script. Reading the script is fine, and you know, you want to know what the actual story is, but I could imagine one movie and he could be imagining entirely a different film. So it sort of makes more sense for me to have a conversation with them about where they see their movie going, and then, you know, I'll start coming up with some ideas and stuff.
Cool. A couple of other things you've done since we last spoke. You worked with Robbie again.
Was that long ago?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, when it
was released. We didn't exactly work together. It's funny because we haven't seen each other in person since before we had kids.
Really?
We talk, you know, every now and again, email each other and stuff. But I think the one you're referring to is a song called My Fuck You to You.
Yeah.
That's actually a song I wrote when I was like 25.
Really?
Or younger, maybe like 23, 24. And Rob always loved it. And it's so I think, Rob. And then again, like 10 years ago, I think we recorded a version. I think maybe we might have rewritten some lyrics to suit him more because it was a very personal song to me, I think.
Yeah.
And it was a song about bullying, basically. Mm. I seem to remember we rewrote some lyrics. And then that was like 10 years ago. And it was actually, God, longer than that because it was around about the time I did my first proper film, I think.
Right, yeah.
Humboldt County. So I think that was around 12 years ago. Jesus Christ. We didn't speak about it much since. I think since then he'd done one or maybe two of my other songs on albums and stuff. And then just out of the blue, he emailed me. He was like, I really want to put this on. He had this album out coming out called Under the Radar.
Right, yeah.
Which is a bunch of like unreleased things and B-sides and all of that stuff. And he was like, I want to put it on there. I was like, great. And then sort of out of nowhere, he shot a video for it.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, it was the highest compliment, really, you know. And I love Rob to bits. He's you know, someone you spend that much time on the road with is like family, basically.
Yeah,
so even though we haven't seen each other, he's sort of one of those people. If I saw him, and we'd sort of pick up right where we left off, basically.
No, I know that. I know exactly the sort of friend you mean.
Yeah, he's a good bloke.
Yeah, no, he always seems like a really sane guy.
So. It's actually really nice to see him. You know, we haven't met each other's kids, but see how he's just all about his kids.
Yeah.
Because that's where my life is now.
Yeah.
And it's really lovely to see that. You know?
I think everybody's quite happy to see him sort of there and settled and, you know, things going where they should be, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, anyway, so that's, that was that. What else? You tell me what I've been working on because I can't remember.
Well, there's the other thing. I mean, you just done We Are All New Town when we last spoke.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You ended up, I mean, that's something which has come back again and again.
Yes.
And I mean, you've just done another one, haven't you?
As Kids.
Notes, Notes for Dunblane and then As Kids. So, I mean, I know.
So you see a theme developing here.
Yeah, I know this is a big thing for you. And it as it should be because, I mean, it's ridiculous.
I think it should be a big thing for everybody.
It should be, yeah. So is this dealing with the same people? Is this the same
people? It's not dealing with the same people. It's dealing with, and it's a very different movie to Newtown. It's dealing with ultimately the kids, not only the kids from the Parkland shooting, but the survivors of the Parkland shooting who then went on, if you remember, a sort of a nationwide bus tour.
Yeah, yeah.
And they really were very instrumental in flipping the house towards the Democrat side.
Yes.
And it wasn't just the kids from Parkland. They, I think, started it, the March for Our Lives movement, but it became kids who were, you know, from inner city gang neighborhoods, from, you know, shootings all over the country. You know, it was like a coalition of kids who were just coming of age voting-wise.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, they did incredible stuff. So it's actually, I mean, obviously it's heartbreaking and it's sad, but it was also incredibly hopeful.
Yes.
And then, you know, I just met all those kids at Sundance and the sense of, right, we're going to fucking go and do something is palpable. Mm. It's pretty incredible. And, you know, it gives me a lot of hope. Even kind of vaguely gives me some hope for this election, although, you know, I wouldn't get my hopes up too much. Yeah, but yeah. But it's, you know, there's a lot of kids there that weren't of voting age when Trump came in and now are. Mm. And I think they're not alone, you know.
No.
What happens there remains to be seen. But I do really believe in those kids, not just sort of when they get old enough to vote, which most of them are now, but also when they get old enough to run for office, because I believe a number of them successfully.
Yeah.
They're an incredibly compelling bunch. Yeah. And they're like a little band, you know, they've been on the road together and it's pretty incredible. But they're very different movies. You know, Newtown was sort of deliberately not a political movie. It was a study in grief.
Yes.
And a really tough thing to watch, but I think really important, incredibly important.
Yes.
And the importance of activism sort of is outlined in that film too. I actually, since the film, and that time we went to Sundance too, and since then I've actually become quite good friends with Mark Barden, and because Mark Barden is also a musician, so we sort of, you know, we got to know each other a little bit. And so, which was actually great, because the reason I got into the film in the first place, I didn't realize they were even making a film. I was looking for a way to become active in that space. And so I called my friend who happened to be producing the movie. And then through Mark, I've been able to sort of stay in touch with that movement a little bit better. Because Mark and Nicole's sort of whole life is activism now. And they're, or, you know, a large chunk of it. And they do incredible things that, you know, keep people safe and people don't really even know about, don't get a lot of publicity. And so it's great and heartening to see all that stuff happening behind the scenes. It doesn't really make the news. It's not, you know, it's not sparkly or sexy. It's just, you know, it's like everyday work. And it makes you realize what politics in this country actually is. And it's very little to do with what you're seeing on the debate stage or in the presidential election.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but it was, you know, those, and also, you know, it was just an interesting, musically, it was just an interesting.
What are you doing musically for something like that?
It's a very electronic score. It's very unlike Newtown. I actually co-composed a film with Brian Reitzel, and Brian's great, and he's very unlike me, and I'm very unlike him. So it was really, you know, it was weird to use the word fun on a movie like this, but it was fun for us to collaborate because we've got such different approaches, such different collections of instruments, such different, you know, sensibilities and palettes and stuff. And it was really, really awesome working with him, actually. Super talented bloke. I'm into synths, but he's a proper synth head and has some great old vintage gear lying around his place. We mostly did it over at his. It was really interesting doing it. And another breakneck project. We did the whole movie in like 2 weeks.
That's crazy.
It was bananas, yeah. Didn't sleep.
Wow. So, in terms of other stuff, I think you did The Titan as well. Mm-hmm. You've done that. So that was your first foray into kind of full-blown sci-fi, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And I loved it. But again, you know, for me, everything is about the story. And it just happened to be a really great script. And, you know, one of the producers is a good friend of mine and also co-wrote the script.
Right.
Incredibly talented writer, a guy called Arash Amel, really, really amazing writer, and had done a couple of passes through the script, I think. And he kind of got me involved with it. And it was really fun to do because that was, you know, that was getting to use all my synth powers, but also, and then do orchestra at Abbey Road. And, you know, it was really great fun to work on. And we got that album out, and that's a score I'm really proud of. It was really, that one felt like, you know, properly mine.
So, I mean, in terms of stuff you're doing at the moment, I know there's Biohackers. I know you're doing that.
How did you even know about that?
I know, because you posted it on your Instagram.
Oh, did I? I was like, there's a bunch of projects that nobody knows about that I've completed or upcoming. There's a couple that I'm not allowed to talk about because of various NDA things. Yes. But you know about Thunder Force. Biohackers is bloody brilliant. It's a German language sci-fi show.
Yeah.
It actually, sci-fi, I don't know if you'd call it sci-fi. It's a thriller. It's definitely sort of a thriller, not quite action, but sort of a thriller. It's somewhat defies genre. It's without wanting to, again, like, I don't know how much I should be talking about this. It's certainly, you know, been announced in the press, but
yes,
I don't want to go into the story too much, but it's, there is certainly a science fiction element to it, but there's also a big science
yeah.
element to it. I think the writer, who again is somebody I've become very good friends with, Christian Ditter, who directed How to Be Single, which I did, I don't know, what was it, 4 years ago or something? I think it was about 4 years ago. And I got the feeling both of us were feeling slightly, you know, sort of getting railroaded into doing comedy after comedy.
Right, yeah.
So he went, right, I'm off to do this thing in Germany, you know, with Netflix. You know, do you fancy coming along? And I was like, of course.
Yes.
And then he showed me the first three episodes. I was just like, oh man, I'm in, all the way in. It was a really cool thing to work on. First of all, I learned a bit of German, which was nice.
That's always yes.
And it was all nicely subtitled for me and everything. but it was really cool because it was the first time in a while I'd decided to do an almost entirely synth score.
Right.
I guess it wasn't completely. I think I played a few, you know, more human instruments on it. But what I got into a lot, which was really fun, was using analog tape.
Okay.
As a sort of means of sampling, which is a very old school, Cage idea, you know. And so I got into doing all these tape loops, and then heard about an old, not old album, but you know, album from like 20 odd years ago called I think it's called the Destruction Loops.
Right.
By William Basinski. You know about that project?
No.
Okay, so the rough, everybody, there's a whole ambient sort of music underworld that if you go on Instagram, you can find all these amazing artists like Heimbach and Amulets and all these guys that I found incredibly inspiring with the techniques that they use to make ambient music, right?
Right, yeah.
And so I heard about this guy, Basinski. They're all obsessed with Basinski. Basinski basically, who's an ambient artist, is, I believe, still around, an ambient artist in New York, super minimalist. And he, at some point, he was transferring a bunch of his old music from tape to digital, right? And somehow didn't realize that the tape loops hadn't been stored correctly and all the oxide was starting to fall off the tape. Mm. So as the tape loops were going round and round and round and recording, the tape started to disintegrate. Literally on the tape machine, the oxide started to peel off and fall on the floor. And as it went on, the music just got destroyed. But he's recording all of this, right?
Yeah.
So you had this incredible sound of this very simple musical loop just starting to disintegrate. And I heard it and was like, oh my God, what an incredible sound. It sounded like a memory. It sounded like...
But the
other notable thing, I think the reason that project became very famous, the reason he's so well known for it, is because he lived in Brooklyn right opposite the World Trade Center, and he literally finished doing it the night before the planes hit the Twin Towers. And I think it was originally released as a tribute to the victims of 9/11.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So anyway, I heard about that, and then I started thinking about, well, I wonder how I could recreate that sound. And so I bought loads of old tape machines, old Nagras and things that they used to use for movie sound, and then, you know, cheap, shitty ones that you'd have seen in somebody's living room in the 70s and 80s, and, you know, quarter inch, half inch, cassettes. You know, I had four track machines that I haven't seen since I was a kid, in school. I've found there's a whole like netherworld of people on Instagram that make shit like this.
Right.
This is an Ond Magnetique, which is basically an old Very Speed Walkman. And this thing, which this guy made, I should give him the credit. I forget what his name is or the name of the company is, but the instrument's called the Ond Magnetique, like the Ond Mark Mag. These buttons basically all control the speed of whatever loop you have playing on that cassette. So you can play a melody, you can tune it, and you can literally play a melody off this cassette.
That's crazy.
And then I found that this guy, Heimbach, who's this incredible ambient artist in Germany, had decided to do the Basinski thing as well, and was running, you know, 40 feet of tape around a room over razors and barbed wire and sandpaper and all kinds of shit. I was like, oh, I'm so doing that. So I did a lot of that for Biohackers. I would write my sketches and write my music, and a lot of it would end up getting put on tape and then just chewed up and spat out.
Wow.
And re-recorded back into Pro Tools.
Yeah, yeah.
And chopped up and all kinds of stuff. So I ended up with all this really incredible ambient material that sort of formed the background of this thing. And there was something about it that was, it wasn't really digital, yet it was, you know, just had a real tactileness to it. That's not a word, but you get what I'm saying.
I know what you mean.
You know, it had this really different feel to it. I don't know. It wasn't, you know, like a pad on a synth. It was just, it was instantly evocative. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I did a lot like that. I mean, at one point I, you know, literally would just have a Nagra tape machine sitting here and a can of beer or something, or a tin of beans with the tape running around it.
Yeah.
And I would just use that as my sample. Instead of using a sampler, I would like record a phrase onto that and then loop it and then play on top of it and everything. And a lot of that became the basis of that music.
That's nuts.
So yeah, that was definitely one of my favorite projects of last year. That was really, really awesome to work on.
I love the fact that, you know, you're not using traditional instruments and you're finding stuff like this together.
I've always loved stuff like that. Even when I write for orchestra.
Yeah.
I've certainly done things that were purely orchestral. You know, another thing I did last year was write a violin concerto.
Right, yeah.
But I mean, even there's an air raid siren in it. There's something, because of course there is, because it's me.
Yes.
I always get tempted to experiment, and I always want to find something for a movie that wasn't there before to mess with, you know. It has been, I mean, funnily enough, Superintelligence was actually pretty much pure orchestra and choir, and that was actually fun and liberating in its own way, because it was like, no, we're gonna just make this as old school as possible. We did very, very little, you know, almost no click tracks. It was all live. And we wanted to do it like, you know, like a much more old school score. But for the most part, I love designing a whole world. You know, I like the idea of building a world for a movie, because that's what movie makers, directors are essentially doing. So I love for there to be a real sense of that in the sonic side of it too.
Yeah, no, I love things like that. You know, as you know, talked to Nate Barr quite a lot, and just the stupid things that he kind of
asked. Yeah, we all go to these insane lengths. Yeah,
yeah, you know, Nate and his bone trumpets and the Wurlitzer and all.
Although he did make me laugh. He was like, "If you hire me now, you're getting a fucking organ, all right?"
I know.
Do you realise how much money this shit costs? You're getting an organ.
Yeah,
no, there's going to be organ in your school somewhere. You might not know it, but there's going to be organ in your school.
Yeah, no, I said that to him when he finished it. I interviewed him just before he finished it, before he'd actually kind of started. And I was like, that's going to be in everything now. And he's like, maybe.
Well, we did a really fun project over there, actually. I don't know if your research has led you to Silent Movies Live.
Oh, yes, I saw you do that. Yeah.
So Silent Movies Live was an incredible thing that, you know, I think will take on more of a life of its own as it goes on. But a few years back, I studied with Dave Newman and for conducting.
Right, yeah.
And his co-teacher in that course was a guy called Angel Velez, who I'm now very good friends with, and who started this thing called Silent Movies Live, which was to raise money for education through Music LA. And basically, you know, me and a handful of other composers, we went and rescored some old silent movies. So I got to rescore, you know, that famous Odessa step sequence from Battleship Potemkin.
Right, yeah.
And which, by the way, is fucking horrific. Have you seen that lately?
No, I haven't seen it.
Good God, you remember it from film school, but, you know, and, you know, something that got jammed down your throat at school. So everybody was like, oh God, Eisenstein, talk to me about montage, yawn. But aside from being, you know, pioneering and masterful and all the other stuff, it is absolutely absolutely horrific to watch, especially if you take off, you know, whatever tinkly old-timey score they've happened to superimpose on it, because there wasn't a score recorded for it, because, of course, it was a silent movie. At the time, you would have either a piano player or, you know, an orchestra playing along with it, and it was commissioned by the Soviets, so they would put various different music up against it. There was, you know, Shostakovich is most famously associated with it, because they would use bits of the Fifth for the, you know, every time there was something dramatic happening, they use the beginning of the Fifth.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, I can't remember what else they used, but if you take off even, and not calling Shostakovich old-timey music, but but it's very closely associated with it. So, and it's very melodramatic, you know, when you pair those two things together, which is a real lesson in music and image creating, being a sort of montage of itself, because the two things have a greater effect than the sum of the parts.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you put something incredibly dramatic against something that's melodramatically acted and is already sort of hand cranked, sped up footage and stuff, it has the effect of looking slightly comical because it's so over the top. So when you take that music off and write completely modern score to it, something quite stripped down, holy crap, it's really quite harrowing. And it was really interesting because I didn't see people's reactions at the concerts, because obviously I was conducting my backwards to the audience. But at the end of the piece, I'd turn around and people were bawling. And I was thinking, Jesus Christ. I mean, I sort of got that idea when I was writing it, but because it was for a concert piece, I didn't really do any mock-ups. Mm. It was, you know, some piano sketches and all on paper.
Yeah, yeah.
So the first time I really, you know, so I got the impression that I was like, oh, this is going to be powerful, but I didn't get the idea that it was really going to, you know, bring people tears or disgust or whatever reaction they had, you know, but people reacted pretty strongly.
Yeah, there's one of those things, though, that when you find that out, it's like, yes.
right. Yeah. And then the other thing, you know, in that sphere that I did with the violin concerto Sarah Chang, that was a whole new experience for me and pretty
was that
incredible.
Just a sort of, do you want to write a violin concerto?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do it.
Well, it was pretty out of the blue. It was, so it was the American Youth Symphony. Mm. Again, an organization that I've followed for years and been to see for years, and bringing it back to the same people, whose principal conductor for years was Dave Newman.
Yes.
So Dave Newman's wife called me now, whatever, a year and a bit ago, and said, would you be interested in doing this? You know, we played Sarah Chang, some up-and-coming composers, and, you know, she loved your stuff and she'd really love you to do it. I was thinking, how did this happen? Yeah, I had no idea, basically. And Sarah Chang's a superstar. Mm. So I was just very honored to be asked. And, you know, I'm not going to say no to that.
No,
just,
correct.
You know, what a challenge. And it happened to be a summer where I had like a little bit of time between movies and, you know, little did I know it was going to take me months. And, and then flying to Philadelphia to workshop it with Sarah, and then, you know, and then also a very long process. But what was really interesting about it was that, you know, they literally said, you can write whatever you want. And it's been a while since I've been in that position.
Yeah.
Because, you know, usually there's a movie, you've got sort of a brief. Mm. And there was nothing. They were just like, well, I don't know, write something for Sarah. You know what Sarah's playing is like, you know, and she wanted, and all her only requirement was she wanted the third movement to be very flashy and technical, because that's sort of what she's, you know, good at and known for.
Yeah.
And, you know, let's have something really fiery and full on.
Something
and,
to show off.
And fun. Yeah. Well, just fun, you know, fun for the audience to sort of sink their teeth into. And I said, okay, great. Other than that, you know, I suddenly went, oh God, what do I write about? You know, because it, it was like, well, I could just write the kind of music I want to hear, but that isn't enough for me to sort of to kick the whole thing off.
Yeah, yeah.
So in the end, I ended up writing about my grandmother who had recently passed away, who was a violinist and who had this incredible history. But, you know, we were incredibly close. She was really the one, besides maybe my dad, who started me off on the path to music when I was a very, very young kid in Prague. And she was born in the First World War, went through the Second World War, went through living behind the Iron Curtain, went through this very, very long and complicated and really amazing history that, you know, would use up your entire hard drive if I told you. But basically, it gave me something to write about.
Yeah.
And the catalyst for the whole thing was you know, you have these conversations with your grandparents about the war or whatever, and they tend to repeat the same stories.
Yeah.
But towards the end of her life, every now and again, a story would come out that I hadn't heard before.
Right. Yeah.
And it was really weird because I thought I'd heard all the stories, but at this point, you know, she was like, "Oh, then there was the one time." And she, I remember her telling me a story about bombs falling on London, and her hearing the bombs off in the distance and coming closer, and how terrified she was. And she described the scene as a baby, as a very, very young kid. It was one of her first memories. And for some reason, it took me literally years to twig that she actually meant, she didn't mean the Blitz, she meant World War One.
Right, yes, of course.
And I hadn't, you know, I thought I knew my war history pretty well. I obviously knew World War II history better than I knew World War I, because I didn't even realize London had been bombed.
Yeah.
In World War I. And it turns out it was worse than the Blitz. It was horrific. These very primitive, you know, there were Zeppelin raids, and then these very primitive bombers were literally chucking bombs over the side and hitting anything. And yeah, so that's what I based the beginning of the piece on, hence the air raid siren.
Right, yes. You know. Makes sense now. Yes.
But yeah, the beginning of the concerto is, it's brutal. It comes from this incredible stillness and quiet, you know, sort of nighttime scene. See, again, I'm thinking of the whole thing as a movie. Of imagining, you know, a little kid asleep somewhere.
Right. Yes.
And then literally just the whole orchestra just explodes, you know.
And
it's great watching the premiere, people just jump out of their seats, because it's so quiet at the beginning and so still, and then just crash, you know, and then this nasty air raid siren sound and the whole orchestra full pelt doing this, you know, crazy wall of sound. People just lost their shit. So that was fun.
Yeah.
And then we're supposed to be recording it at some point.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Cool. I was going to say, is it being sort of...
Not yet, but I'd sort of gotten a message from Sarah at some point, and then I read somewhere she did an interview with Stradivarius magazine, or The Strad, or whatever it's called.
Right.
Saying that she wanted to record it, and then I got a call about it recently, so... When we all get a break, I think we'll do that. Yeah.
Awesome. So, in terms of other stuff at the moment, anything else you can talk about? I know there's a bunch of things you can't.
But I just did a show called The Outer Banks.
Oh, cool.
Which is a Netflix show. Which is sort of a, how do I describe it? It's about a bunch of kids living in South Carolina. That was the Outer Banks.
One of the Carolinas.
The Carolinas. Here's showing my ignorance here. And there's a sort of a rich side of the island and a poor side of the island. And, you know, in the holiday season, the poor kids are basically waxing the rich kids' boats. And so there's opposing gangs. And it's, you know, again, can't reveal too much about the plot, but basically these opposing gangs are involved in somewhat of a treasure hunt chase. It's a big adventure piece.
That's sounding a bit Goonies.
It definitely has some of that DNA.
Yeah.
They're older kids. They're sort of in their late teens.
Right,
but,
that was
fun. So I've got that's done. I've got that coming out. I did a show called Council of Dads.
Oh, yes. I'm aware of that one.
Yeah,
yes.
Which is also actually a really beautiful piece of work. And that's a very acoustic score with a, you know, string quartet and mostly just me playing guitar and piano. And,
nice.
And a really good show that I really hope they do well, actually.
Mm.
That's coming out soon, I think.
Yes, I think it is. That's not a pilot this year. It was last year.
There's a bunch of things that I've just been working flat out.
Mm.
I'm probably forgetting something, but there's, you know, a bunch of things coming out that I already sort of have in the can that are done. And yeah, like I said, and then there's a couple of things I can't talk about that are either happening or upcoming. And
to go and update your IMDb with the...
I don't, because I just, they're going to get to it when they're going to get to it. And, you know, I don't want to cause too much speculation when it's a project that people don't know much about, and it's...
I get it, yeah.
It'll be there when it gets there.
Right, so I should let you go back to work. Last couple of questions for you, which, again, we always do the same ones. So you've had these before, but let's see where they are now. Firstly, what TV shows are you watching at the moment?
I'm not watching any. I don't get time. What have I watched?
What was the last thing you watched?
Shit. I watched a bunch of the movies because I'm... an Academy member now, you know. Oh, they let me in.
Really?
God knows why they'd let me in, but they did. And so, you know, Parasite, 1917, right, yeah. Ford v Ferrari, I mean, all, you know, some of the movies. And I was really in awe of 1917. I thought it was an incredible film, and Tom Newman just did. I love Tom Newman's sort of, I don't know whether it was conscious or not, but it felt like there was a nod in there to Vaughan Williams.
Right.
Or just like a very English sounding score. Really? And that, just not just a story, because again, like those war stories that we grew, people of my generation grew up with, because our grandparents and great grandparents.
Yes.
But that and the very English sort of feel to some of the orchestral music just really got straight to my heart. I thought that was incredible. What else did I watch that I really, really liked? I loved Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So it was great. There's so many good movies. Jojo Rabbit,
phenomenal film.
Yeah, so much good stuff out there, man. Mm. It's really actually pretty humbling to become a member of the Academy, because you're now like with the elite.
Yeah, yeah.
And at the same time, there's always new talent coming up. Yeah. Sort of, some nonsense is similar. It's when people like that sort of welcome you, it's pretty awe-inspiring. And then it's all inspiring to be surrounded by, you know, some of those people. Just blows you away.
Yeah.
It's really incredible.
Yeah.
Really, really great.
Last question. Uh-huh. If you had the opportunity to work on any TV show, past, present or future, can't be one you've already worked on.
Does it have to be a TV show or a movie?
Because it's you. Usually you say it has to be a TV show, but because it's you.
Because I'm really probably spending more time on movies.
Yeah, I will let you get away with it.
You know why that's a difficult question? Because the movies that I've always loved, you can't imagine them being divorced from the score.
No.
Can't imagine Apocalypse Now being divorced from The Doors. You can't imagine, you know, The Godfather being divorced from those themes. You can't imagine Taxi Driver being divorced from Bernard Herrmann. So it's really tough to sort of say, if there was a film like...
Yeah.
I mean, 1917 would be up there.
Big war epic.
The big war movies that... I'm a huge war movie buff, which is funny because I'm also the big... I'm a bit of a dichotomy. Like, I'm the biggest peace hippie, peace-loving hippie lefty of all time. And yet, I'm a huge martial arts fan, huge UFC and boxing fan, and I love war movies. And yet... just the, you know, total hate violence, hate, you know, so weird. I don't know, I'm weird. Sue me. Saving Private Ryan, Thin Red Line. This is more like movies you wish you could have done, but, because then I could say Star Wars. But what, are you talking more recent or just
anything? So, if anybody's got like a big... epic war movie coming up that they need us.
Oh my god, yeah. I would absolutely love to do one of those and haven't had the opportunity yet. I do love, again, not to pigeonhole things too much, but I love movies that are vast in scope and yet come from a simple idea.
Yeah.
So The Matrix is a great example, actually. Right, yeah. It's a very, very singular idea. Very singular idea. At least the first one was.
Yes.
On a grand scale. Saving Private Ryan, same thing. 1917, same thing, you know. But I do love a movie like Parasite, too, that's, you know, that's just different.
Yeah.
Heat is a huge one for me.
Yes.
And I also think, you know, Elliot Goldenthal is one of my favourite composers, and there's all sorts of music in that movie besides his, but there was something that whole movie captured about Los Angeles. This is years before. I think...
Yeah, yeah.
I don't even know if I'd... I think I'd been to LA as a kid at that point, but I knew nothing about LA, really, in real terms, certainly not living here. But even then, you could see that the whole film was this weird, fucked-up love letter to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
From the photography to, the locations, and the score really captured that, especially that nighttime vista that they created, you know, it's like De Niro and Amy Brenneman on the balcony with the lights of Hollywood in the background. I mean, that stuff is just like, that's the kind of thing I live for. I think it's a movie that has obviously great storytelling and a very fundamentally simple idea at its core, but then that combined with something that's spectacular visually, that, you know, because when I write, there's so many things that are inspiring to me, and that could be the lighting, the photography, the costumes, the sets. You know, it takes a real master to bring all those things together. I love working with people like that. I love working with people who, you see it in musicians and you see it in directors and you see it in artists who are just there are lots of good talented artists around, and then there's sort of a cut above that, this echelon of people who are, they're just so in charge of what they do, they're just so on their shit, and that's incredibly exciting to be around.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to let you go back to it.
Cool, man.
A real pleasure.
Yeah, likewise, likewise.
We'll try and not leave it 2-3 years.
So, and that was, how many times have we spoken now, you said? Seven?
That will be six, I think.
Wow.
This is the sixth.
My God.
You're still, because Nate was too busy this time, you are still beating Nate. So
by one.
By one, I think, at the moment. you were pulling level.
So, nice. That's amazing. Wow. That gives me some perspective on how long I've been at it.
But, yeah.
Yeah, it was an absolute pleasure, mate.
Yeah, lovely.
Cool. Thanks for dropping out there.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.